Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The relationship between Russia and Ukraine is marked by a very long history of imperial domination and oppression. And Russian nationalists, Putin is a Russian nationalist, they see the separate existence of Ukrainians as something which will lead to the destruction not only of the so-called Russian civilizational space, like post-Soviet space, but also of the body of the Russian nation itself.
As 17 Ukrainians are killed in a Russian missile strike on a Donetsk market, and the United States pledges $1 billion more for Ukraine, we speak with activists from Ukraine and Russia on a joint speaking tour of the United States to speak out against the war. We'll look at the humanitarian crisis in the Democratic Republic of the Congo as well.
What we saw and heard in the Democratic Republic of Congo was shocking, heartbreaking, and sobering. We have seen that in the past 18 months, and that alone, the humanitarian situation in eastern Congo has deteriorated to an alarming extent. It is frankly the worst situation we have ever seen, with around 8 million people in need of urgent humanitarian assistance.
We'll speak to Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's just back from the DRC. We'll also talk with him about the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A Russian missile struck a crowded outdoor market in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region Wednesday, killing at least 17 people, including a child, and injuring 32 others. It was one of the deadliest attacks in Ukraine in months. Diana Kolodak, who works in a pharmacy next to the market, described the attack.
One woman walked into the pharmacy on her own. Her arm and leg were bleeding. She had a big wound on her arm. Another woman was carried inside by soldiers. She had one open fracture and bone was sticking out of her leg.
In Russia, officials say one person was injured, at least three buildings and several cars destroyed as a Ukrainian drone struck Wednesday near the headquarters of Russia's Southern Military District Command in the city of Rostov. Romania's president said Wednesday parts of a Russian drone were found on its territory near the Danube River following a Russian assault on a Ukrainian port earlier this week. The president said Romania remains on alert after the attack and is in contact with its NATO allies.
If it is confirmed that these elements belong to a Russian drone, such a situation would be completely inadmissible and a serious violation of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Romania, a NATO ally.
Sudan's military ruler has issued a decree ordering the dissolution of the Rapid Support Forces, the rival paramilitary group that's fighting Sudan's army since April. The decree came amidst continued heavy fighting in Sudan's capital region. On Tuesday, witnesses said artillery attacks by the Sudanese army killed at least 32 people, injured dozens more in the city of Omdurman. On Wednesday, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, visited Sudanese refugees in Chad, where she announced new U.S. sanctions on leaders of the RSF over widespread human rights abuses. In Gabon, leaders of last week's coup said Wednesday ousted President Ali Bongo has been released from house arrest and is free to seek medical care abroad.
The former president of the Republic, Ali Bongo Ondimba, is free to move about. He may, if he wishes, travel abroad for medical checkups.
Ali Bongo suffered a stroke 5 years ago that left him partially paralyzed. Members of his family, including his wife and son, remain under house arrest. They're accused of high treason for looting Gabon's treasury and enriching themselves at the expense of Gabon. The World Food Program says it'll further slash the amount of humanitarian assistance it provides to Afghanistan, where more than 15 million people face severe food insecurity. WFP Afghanistan country director Xiaowei Li blamed a lack of funding for the latest cuts, which will see the UN agency provide emergency food aid to just 3 million Afghans.
This month, we're having to reduce another 2 million. That means 10 million people that we had served previously and who need assistance are going to bed hungry without any food assistance that WFP is able to provide.
We'll have more on the humanitarian crises in Afghanistan, as well as the Democratic Republic of the Congo and elsewhere later in the broadcast with Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. The Biden administration says it's canceling all existing oil and gas drilling leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska and banning drilling on 13 million acres, or over half the National Petroleum Reserve. But the new regulations will not block the $8 billion Willow Project, which Biden approved earlier this year, despite widespread objections from environmentalists and indigenous activists. Climate activists are calling on the Biden administration to go further and end all oil and drilling. A judge in Georgia has ruled that two of Donald Trump's co-defendants in the state's election subversion case will be tried together beginning October 23rd. Fulton County Judge Scott McAfee on Wednesday granted a request by Sidney Powell and Kenneth Chesbro for a speedy trial in the case, though he denied their request to be tried separately. In Colorado, a new lawsuit seeks to bar Donald Trump from the 2024 presidential ballot. Six Colorado voters argue Trump's actions before, during, and after the January 6, 2021 insurrection disqualify him from running, citing the 14th Amendment. Meanwhile, a federal judge in New York has found Donald Trump liable for defaming writer E. Jean Carroll for a second time. Trump continued to mock and disparage Carroll even after a New York jury earlier this year ordered him to pay $5 million to Carroll for sexually abusing her at a department store in the 90s and defaming her. U.S. District Judge Lewis Kaplan said a trial in January will be limited to determining how much to award E. Jean Carroll in further damages. The Senate's top Republican says he has no plans to retire and will finish his term. 81-year-old Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell made the remarks Wednesday amidst widespread speculation over his health following a series of falls, a concussion, and two recent incidents where he froze up while answering reporters' questions.
When you say to those who are calling on you to step down, do you have any plans to retire anytime soon?
I have no announcements to make on that subject.
What do you say to those who are...
I'm going to finish my term as leader, and I'm going to finish my Senate term.
This week, McConnell released a letter from Congress's attending physician who said tests had ruled out a stroke or seizure. The special counsel investigating President Biden's son says he'll seek a criminal indictment against Hunter Biden on tax and gun charges by September 29th. This comes after a judge in July rejected a previous plea deal that would have seen Biden avoid jail time. In Mexico, the former Mexico City mayor, Claudia Sheinbaum, was selected by the governing Morena Party as its candidate for the 2024 presidential election. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is not eligible to run again since leaders can only serve a single six-year term, according to Mexico's constitution. Sheinbaum, a close ally of AMLO, is seen as a favorite ahead of June's election as Morena rules 22 of Mexico's 32 states. She spoke after her selection was announced.
Today, democracy won. Today, the people of Mexico decided, and I am the national coordinator to defend the transformation based on the people of Mexico's decision. This work is teamwork.
Last week, an opposition coalition selected its presidential candidate, lawmaker Xochitl Gálvez, meaning the two top contenders are women, and Mexico's expected to elect its first woman president. Half of Mexico's Congress is female, and its cabinet is gender balanced. In more news from Mexico, the nation's Supreme Court has decriminalized abortion, ruling bans on the procedure are a violation of human rights. Abortion is still considered unlawful in two-thirds of Mexican states, but people in those states can now receive abortions at federal medical facilities, and states will be barred from penalizing those patients and providers. It's part of a wave of abortion rights victories across Latin America, Colombia, Argentina, Uruguay, and Guyana have also moved to either legalize or decriminalize abortion. Meanwhile, here in the United States, anti-abortion crusaders are pushing new measures to make abortion access even more challenging. Texas cities and counties are passing new laws that criminalize driving through them to get to an abortion provider. New data shows abortions increased in the first half of the year in states that still allow the procedure. Those states have been absorbing patients forced to travel from places where abortions were banned following the overturning of Roe v. Wade last summer. A federal judge on Wednesday ordered Texas Governor Greg Abbott to remove his dangerous floating border barrier in the Rio Grande. The Justice Department sued over the barrier in July, which has been implicated in at least two migrant deaths and many more injuries. The 1,000-foot-long line of buoys are separated by circular saw blades. Governor Abbott has already appealed the order. The Immigrant Legal Resource Center calls the buoys a symbol of the hate-filled and inhumane policies Governor Abbott has embraced as he continues to wage war on immigrants. The beautiful Rio Grande River has been turned into a militarized zone, they said. In Spain, soccer star Jenny Hermoso has filed a sexual assault criminal complaint against Luis Rubiales, the head of the Spanish Soccer Federation, who forcibly kissed her during the World Cup trophy ceremony. The sexual assault was witnessed live by millions of people who are tuning in to celebrate Spain's historic victory. Rubiales has been temporarily suspended by FIFA while the team's coach was fired. Hermoso's teammates vowed not to play for the national team again unless management was changed. Meanwhile, protesters have been taken to the streets in Spain in solidarity with Jenny Hermoso.
This is a crime. This is clearly sexual harassment under Spanish law, and not only Spanish law, but also under European law. The Istanbul Convention, signed by Europe in 2011 and ratified by Spain in 2014, considers this as sexual abuse, and it is a crime.
Here in New York, a court in Westchester County has exonerated a black man nearly 48 years after he was wrongfully convicted on rape charges. Leonard Mack served more than 7 years in prison after a jury found him guilty in 1975. DNA has since eliminated him as the perpetrator and identified a different man who's confessed to the crime. The Innocence Project says it's the longest ever wrongful conviction to be overturned by DNA evidence. Mack was officially exonerated Tuesday, his 72nd birthday.
I thank God that finally the truth came out. And now I can truly say, now I can truly say that I'm free.
And acclaimed documentary filmmaker Nancy Bersky has died at 78. Her first film, The Loving Story, chronicled the relationship which led to the Supreme Court's landmark decision legalizing interracial relationships. It won a Peabody for its, quote, gorgeous and sympathetic telling of a couple's fight to persevere in the face of injustice. Bersky founded and for 10 years ran the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. In 2017, she appeared on Democracy Now! To talk about her film, The Rape of Race Taylor, about a 24-year-old black sharecropper who was gang raped in 1944 and refused to be silenced. This is Nancy Bersky on Democracy Now!
Recy Taylor is amazingly courageous for speaking up. As you mentioned, very few women did that. They were afraid for their lives, their families would be threatened, and their friends' livelihoods would be threatened. So what she did was extraordinary. We made this film before this Me Too movement. We had no idea that this would all erupt. But now, as I look back on it, I realize that Recy Taylor's story is the first link in a long chain. Not even the first link. It really goes back to slavery. But it is a very pivotal link in a chain that goes right through the civil rights movement, right up through Black Power, and obviously is resolved today.
To see the whole interview, you can go to democracynow.org. And those are the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we speak with activists from Ukraine and Russia on a joint speaking tour of the United States to speak out against the war. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
phone's always waiting on tomorrow. Itching, fiending for whatever happens next. But what if I told you they're all lying? And I love you for who you are right now, the best. Everyone thinks they're going the wrong way, but they're looking at their maps all wrong. 'Cause everywhere, somewhere to someone, and in a rush you cannot dance the smooth, slow songs. So I'm gonna slow on down some way, somehow. Today ain't different from the rest.
Right now, the best by Zach Bryan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show looking at the war in Ukraine. On Wednesday, a Russian missile hit an outdoor market in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region, killing 17 and injuring 32. It was one of the deadliest attacks in Ukraine in months. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky condemned the, quote, utter inhumanity of the attack. Diana Khodak, who works in a pharmacy next to the market, described the missile strike.
I only saw a flash and then shouted to my colleagues, lie on the floor. All the customers lay down on the floor. All the pharmacy employees lay down on the floor. I heard things falling over. Then everything was covered in smoke and fire started. One wounded woman walked into the pharmacy on her own. Her arm and her leg were bleeding. She had a big wound on her arm. Another woman was carried inside by soldiers. She had an open fracture and her bone was sticking out from her leg. She was very pale. She remained conscious but in shock while she was given first aid.
The attack on the Ukrainian market occurred as U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken made a surprise visit to Kyiv, where he met with President Zelensky. Blinken announced $1 billion in new U.S. aid to Ukraine.
We will continue to stand by Ukraine's side, and today we're announcing new assistance totaling more than $1 billion in this common effort. That includes $665.5 million in new military and civilian security assistance. In total, we committed over $43 billion in security assistance since the beginning of the Russian aggression.
In Moscow, the Kremlin criticized Blinken's visit, saying it's proof the United States plans to keep funding Ukraine's war effort, quote, until the last Ukrainian. We're joined now by two activists, one Russian, one Ukrainian. They're on a speaking tour of the United States organized by the Ukraine Solidarity Network, a group which supports Ukraine's struggle for self-determination. Ilya Budryatskis is a Russian historian and political theorist who is previously based in Moscow and recently joined University of California, Berkeley as a visiting scholar. He's co-founder of POSLE, which means after, a network of Russian intellectuals in exile who oppose the war against Ukraine. He's the author of the award-winning book Dissidents Among Dissidents, Ideology, Politics, and the Left in Post-Soviet Russia. Hanna Perhoda is a Ukrainian historian at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland. She's a member of the Ukrainian Democratic Socialist Organization, which is called Socialny Rukh. She's also part of the European Network for Solidarity with Ukraine. We welcome you both to New York and to the United States and to Democracy Now! Hanna, we want to begin with you. Can you describe what's happening to your country now, your response to the latest attack in the Donetsk region? In fact, Hanna, are you also from the Donetsk region?
Yeah, basically, the essence of this war is the same as 1 year before. That means that most of the Ukrainians living in any part of the country are facing a threat of Russian missiles targeting their residential areas, because Russia has engaged itself in a strategy of terror against civilians. And this continues as we can witness it with this horrible attack on a city in the Donetsk region. And yeah, in fact, I'm from this region, and it's very painful for me to see all these streets and cities that I spent my childhood in to be completely destroyed by the ongoing war. But also what defines this war is the fact that a big part of the Ukrainian territories are still under the Russian occupation, and civilians living in these territories are facing torture. They are facing murder, they are facing rape, and also forced displacement, as well as the mass kidnapping of children who are sent to Russia in order to be re-educated. That this is something we must not forget, that the reality of this war is still horrible. So, but also something which is not fading away is the consensus among the Ukrainian population, even despite all the political disagreements inside the Ukrainian population, because it's a complex society. All the citizens of Ukraine are united by a strong consensus that only our capability to liberate the whole territory of Ukraine could be a precondition for the lasting peace for Ukraine and for the whole region, because Russia and Vladimir Putin are still openly denying the very right of Ukrainians to exist as a state and as a separate society from Russia.
Hannah, could you elaborate on that, the sense that you have of what the trajectory and the purpose of this war are now for Russia and where you see this going?
I will try to summarize it because it's not an easy war to understand maybe from outside. But basically, this war is not a response for some external military threat for Russia emanating from NATO, for example. But this war is a response of the Russian ruling classes to the internal threat to their power, because Russian civil society was quite active on the last years, and also being under threat of democratizing Russian society. The Putin and his clan actually try to eliminate all possible democratizing tendencies in the neighborhood. That's why the war in Ukraine was provoked by Russia in 2014. That's why also Putin invaded it. And it is necessary to understand that the reasons of this war are internal to Russia and has more to do with the internal politics than with some external international relations between Russia and, for example, the Western countries. So actually, we see that we don't have an easy exit from this situation, because Putin doesn't seem to show any clear demands of what he actually wants from Ukraine. I think this war is not about territories. It's about the full control of Ukraine in order to prevent it to become a prosperous and democratic country, because it may awaken some dangerous ideas among Russians themselves, who are also tired of the autocratic regime and of the extreme inequality in Russia. So basically, the danger of this war, that even if somehow Ukraine cedes some part of territories, or even the whole territory of Ukraine would belong to Russia, the war would continue, because any democratic country on the borders of Russia is a threat for the Putin's regime.
Ilya Budraitskis, I'd like to bring you in to the conversation. We've had you on the show a few times, the first time, in fact, just weeks before the Russian invasion, and then on two subsequent occasions when we did not disclose your location, though you had fled the country, and now you're at UC Berkeley. If you could talk about what the situation now is in Russia, respond to what Hannah said about the protests that began in Russia in 2011, how they were connected. You've said that over the last several years, the Russian population has been preparing or has been prepared for this war. Talk about what you know of the situation on the ground there now.
Thank you. So basically, I agree with what Anna was saying. This criminal war is not just war against Ukraine. It's a war of the Russian regime against its own society. And this war started not just a year ago. It started as you said, from 2011, then in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea, and somehow you see the combination of the external and internal goals of Putin's regime in his actions against his own population and against his neighbors. So definitely this war is ongoing to save the regime, to strengthen its power over its own population, but it's also about the imperial and imperialist ambitions of Putin's Russia in the post-Soviet space, and probably Ukraine will be not the last goal of this aggression if the conflict will continue in different ways and this regime will continue to exist. As you mentioned, in 2011, Putin was challenged by the rise of the huge protest movement. That was a movement for the democratization of political system, for some more just redistribution of the wealth in the country. And in fact, the annexation of Crimea, the rally around the flag that appeared in the Russian society, after it was the answer of the regime to this democratic challenge. Then, even just few years before the full-scale invasion, you also saw the rise of the new protest movement, the protest movement of the more younger generation that was not participated in the protests of 2011, and the full-scale invasion of Ukraine somehow marked a significant turn in the very character of the Putin's regime, which became an open and extremely repressive dictatorship. So for now in Russia you have much more political prisoners than you had, for example, in the late Soviet period under Brezhnev. You have a total censorship, you have an atmosphere of fear, you have the more and more repressive measures coming from the government, but somehow we see that Even in this very dramatic situation, there are still many kind of hidden dissent in the Russian society.
I wanted to ask Hanna Perechoda. Antony Blinken just went to Kyiv in the surprise visit. I think it's his third time. And he made the announcement of $1 billion in aid to the Ukraine war, the counteroffensive, very difficult. The U.S. is now apparently going to promise depleted uranium ammunition before that, cluster bombs violating a treaty, not that the U.S. has signed on to, but 110 other countries have signed on to against cluster bombs. I'm wondering about your thoughts thoughts on the war. It sounds like for many of the Ukrainians, there's a lot